Welcome to the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. In today's episode, we discuss money market funds and other investment instruments, investment portals, and a new solution from ICD with Sebastian Ramos and Zachary Brown from ICD. Sebastian is an EVP, Global Trading and Products, and leads ICD's global trading operations and investment product lineup. Zach is an EVP product and became a part of ICD in 2022 with the aim of formulating and implementing a cohesive vision for the investment reporting offering. ICD is a Treasury's trusted provider of institutional investment technology. For more than two decades, ICD has developed workflow solutions to assist organizations with independent research, trading, analytics, and investment reporting. In the episode of today, expect to learn about the different ways treasurers can invest their money, how to overcome the hassle of investing through multiple channels in multiple instruments with multiple counterparties, what is an independent investment portal and why is it important to consider an independent investment portal for treasurers, about one of the newest innovations from ICD, and like always, much, much more. We hope you will enjoy the episode. If that is the case, and when you're thinking about how you found our podcast, chances are that it was through word of mouth, social media, or a recommendation from your favorite podcast platform. And this is our only request to you. The best way you can support the podcast is to head to YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Corporate Treasury 101. That would mean the world to us and help more people learn about treasury. And with all that being said, please welcome Sebastian and Zach.
Sebastian, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really excited to delve into today's topic. We want to start really basic. So Sebastian, since you're the expert in this field, what is a money market fund and what are they actually used for?
That's a great question, Hussam, and appreciate you having us on the podcast today as well. Money market funds been around for nearly 50 years, and they're at their core essentially an open-ended mutual fund or UCITS in Europe. And they're heavily regulated in terms of the nature of their portfolio, the quality, the duration, the amount of liquidity that they have to have on hand as well. And they also have different investment objectives. So some will invest in high quality corporate and financial debt. Others are more restrictive in terms of only investing in government and sovereign debt, or in the case of the U.S., certain municipal debt as well. At the end of the day, though, they do offer, an attractive investment for those looking for the combination of safety, liquidity, and a competitive yield, and have become one of the main investment vehicles for a lot of institutional investors that are carrying, in particular, a lot of cash.
That makes a lot of sense. So they're basically just an investment vehicle that have something real on the back end of them. Right. So some, like you said, a sovereign government or another company, right?
So essentially what they do is they go out and buy securities of different types, again, depending on the particular investment mandate for that fund. And then as an end investor, you're buying shares in the fund. And so that share gives you a pro rata proportional interest in those securities that are held in the overall portfolio for the fund. And so it's a really good way as a client to get essentially instant diversification. So you don't have to go out and buy 50 bank names in order to be able to fully diversify your portfolio. You can buy single fund or even five funds if you want to diversify at a manager level and still get that diversification, because there are restrictions around percentage concentration in the funds as well, where they can't in many cases be over 5% of the fund with any single name. And so it's a great way to get that diversification without having to go out and facilitate that yourself.
So it's a bit like an index fund, right? So what's the difference between that and an index fund?
It's a little bit like an index fund. Same, I guess, concept in that, you have a portfolio of investments, but it's different from an index fund in that you're not trying to purchase securities to essentially mirror the construct of an index. You're going out and you're purchasing securities of a certain type that meet the investment objectives of the fund, that are in line with the regulations that govern the quality of the portfolio. But there's no mandate to have, a certain number of one name, a certain number of one other name, other than, not being overly concentrated with a particular name. if that makes sense.
And are they actively managed, those portfolios? Are they being changed all the times by whoever the fund manager is?
They are to a certain degree, but a goal of the funds is really for them to hold the investments to maturity. They're designed to purchase, whether it be, a short-term debt issuance by a financial institution or a government, and then hold that to maturity. They're restricted in terms of both average duration and maximum duration as well. So they can't really buy securities that are in excess of a year. And then they have weighted average maturities typically of 60 days, and then a weighted average life, which goes to the legal final maturity of 120 days for the portfolio. So they're really designed to be very short, and holds most of the securities to maturity. Now, they can liquidate securities depending on, what flows in and out of the funds they have, but it isn't really designed to, buy and sell securities on a day-to-day basis. It's more managing the portfolio to handle the inflow and outflow of cash that they see on a daily basis, and, investing, at the best prevailing rate and the best prevailing options if they have, net inflows for the day.
Okay. That's, you're talking about like on the market, money market fund level for a treasurer. What's the difference between me using a money market fund as my short-term investment vehicle versus the other options I have available?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So traditionally, there are a couple different avenues you can go. So as a corporate treasurer, most of the cash tends to get invested in bank deposits, and that can be in the form of demand deposit, MMDA accounts, term deposits as well, or they can go and they can buy securities directly. And they can, purchase commercial paper, U.S. treasuries, other sovereign issuance, depending on, the nature of the portfolio. And there are advantages and disadvantages to all of these. The nice thing about a money market fund is that it, has a lot of the same degree of liquidity that you find in a bank account. Most of them are available to be sold same day. So on any given day, if you need cash, you can, very much like a bank account, liquidate your position in the money market fund and have that cash in your bank account same day. But if you're looking at it from a bank perspective, you're investing in bank deposits. That's a single credit that you're exposed to. So, if you have a deposit with, BNP or JP Morgan Chase or whatever the bank is, you're ultimately exposed to that bank's balance sheet and, the credit quality of that bank. And that's in part why most treasurers have in their investment policy strict guidelines around, the bank quality in terms of specific parameters on ratings and so forth. But if you're in a money market fund, you get sort of that instant diversification. So you're not concentrated to just a single counterparty. And we've seen that, be critical. This last year, we've gone through a series of episodes in terms of, banks that had, fairly high credit quality ratings running into trouble. And so, whether it's Silicon Valley Bank or even internationally Credit Suisse, these are all very large financial institutions that ultimately based on certain aspects of their portfolio that are, not as transparent to the end investor, they ultimately, ran into some difficulty. And, there's some question, if you were a depositor at Silicon Valley Bank, am I going to be able to get back the total of my deposit? And certainly the, government insurance, FDIC insurance on that wouldn't cover the overall balances that most of the large institutional clients had. And so we've seen, a lot of clients and particularly corporate treasurers take a step back and really look at their cash and really want to understand, am I really concentrated with a particular name? And should I, put all of my eggs in one or two or three baskets? And that's really where money market funds are a nice complement. They're not going to entirely replace bank deposits because, there is a need to use banks for various different operational reasons, but they are a nice complement and allow you to, get that diversification without, having to have accounts at 100 different banks in order to, have a similar type of diversification across your portfolio.
Mm. So maybe a very stupid question, but what does the bank do of the money that you invest through a money market fund? Like what is it used for?
So the cash is used to buy securities. So a money market fund is essentially an pooled investment vehicle. So when you put money in a money market fund, they will go out and buy securities as investments to hold in their portfolio. Now, there's net benefit to those that are looking to raise cash. So if you're a financial institution or a company and you're looking to raise cash, they're one of the buyers of your commercial paper or your short-term debt issuance. And so they are, facilitator to the market in terms of providing cash to the market. But the fund itself is receiving cash in from investors and then investing that in securities that match the investment policy of the fund itself.
Hmm. And so that's done every day overnight? Because so you mentioned something about it being daily, but does that mean that as a treasurer, I just say, okay, at the end of the day, I want to have a certain yield on my cash at hand on my bank account. Do I just invest on an MMF overnight, and in the morning when I reopen my account and I'm done with my coffee, I can just get my money back?
There are many clients that trade exactly that way, that will invest their excess cash at the end of the day, and then in the morning they'll pull back all of it or some of it or some component of it. There are others that have more stable cash flows, and they'll use it more longer term. Again, longer term being relative, but they may not need to access the cash for 2 weeks, 3 months. And as long as it's not significantly longer in duration, where you might look at other longer duration alternatives, there are same day liquids. So you can trade them every single day if you like. We have many clients that do that today.
Makes a lot of sense. So obviously with the recent economic rise in interest rates, one might ask the question of what's the best option for me to invest my money in, because that definitely becomes critical when you go from 0% interest rate or maybe even negative interest rate in Europe to 4-5% or you name it. What has been the role of money market funds in that specific economic environment compared to, well, the last decades, basically?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So money market funds have been great beneficiaries of the current interest rate environment because the portfolios are by nature very short, and there's a degree of ability to customize the portfolio within the constraints of the rules around duration to be shorter or longer depending on the interest rate environment. What you found is many funds, knowing the nature of interest rates and where we were in the cycle, kept their weighted average maturities very short. In some cases, multiple days, less than 10 days, for example. And so as a result, we're able to fully capture most of the FOMC or other central bank movements within a day or within a week in many cases. And that if you compare that to longer dated securities you might buy yourself or bank deposits, they're certainly not as responsive in many cases to those same type of interest rate changes. And so they've been large beneficiaries of, and we've seen large inflows into funds over that period, in part because of their strength in that type of interest rate cycle.
Okay, super interesting. So that has gone up, the usage of those money market funds in general.
I mean, the inverted yield curve also helps. I mean, when you look at the market premium you get by going out on the curve, it's pretty low right now. And so, if you think about the kind of risks that you would have to take in order to go longer on the curve right now, it's just not very appealing. And so as people's maturities rolled off on some of their more longer duration portfolios, a lot of them reinvested in short products that were easy and highly liquid, like a money market fund.
Super interesting. But going back to the bank's perspective on this, like managing that daily cash, like if it's going up and down, up and down, up and down, because Treasury is using a short-term tool so much, like how are they managing the liquidity on their side? Are they funding it with the other operations, or are they also able to liquidate that quickly?
Well, so the portfolios themselves are designed to be very liquid. So the primary function of a money market fund is to serve as a cash vehicle, and they're used to the type of flows that we're talking about. But even beyond that, there are regulations that mandate the amount of liquidity they have in the portfolio. And so many of them have a requirement, for example, that they maintain at least 10% of the portfolio overnight. And so that's a strict requirement. And so 10% of the portfolio is available the next day as cash until they need to reinvest it again based on inflows or outflows. Similarly, they have requirements on 7-day liquidity. And so many of them have a requirement that they maintain 30%. In the US, there are some funds that in the next couple of years that will go up to 50%. And so there are strict liquidity requirements that are built in the portfolio that allow for them to meet sort of those day-to-day operational needs. And they also manage the portfolio around known inflows and outflows. So things like corporate tax day or certain times of the year where there are large inflows or outflows, they'll also effectively manage the portfolio to carry extra liquidity to be able to prepare for some of those type of events as well. But at the end of the day, the nice thing about a money market fund as opposed to holding securities directly is they have that pool of liquidity that's available to you, which is what helps facilitate sort of that daily movement if you want to pull in and out of the fund on a daily basis.
A 50% liquidity, isn't that more than cash reserve requirements for banks? Like banks' cash reserve requirements are like 10%.
It is rather high.
Why is the bank doing this if they have to hold that much cash.
Well, so yeah, so I mean, these are the requirements that are on the funds. The 50% is a newer requirement that is specific only to U.S. prime domestic funds. Other funds, they're more focused on the 30% liquidity. And there's certain types of treatment for different types of securities in terms of that liquidity bucket. So it's not just, for example, that 7-day maturity is not just securities that only mature in 7 days. It can be securities, for example, that have a put provision that allow you to liquidate them within 7 days. They also have special treatment for government agency issuance so that if you're buying U.S. government debts, because those are liquid instruments, even if they have a maturity 30 days out, they can still be counted in that bucket. And so it's a more holistic calculation than just simple maturity, but it's really driven by the liquidity of the actual securities in the portfolio.
And they see their flows not necessarily just like dipping, right? Like they know their average flows, and so they can predict, you know, try to predict ahead of time. There's people getting in and people getting out of these funds all the time. So it's not that like, you know, every day 90% of the fund is being exited and then every day, you know, jumps back up before the end of the period. That's not how typical flows work in these funds.
Yeah, usually it's only on the order of a few percentage points of the portfolio are turned over each day. You're not seeing large volumes outside of, you know, particular days where, you know, it might grow to 5, maybe 7%, but usually not significant portions of the portfolio that are being liquidated on a daily basis.
And give us an order of magnitude on the kind of returns that treasurers can expect on these kind of things versus other instruments. Like, how does it compare?
Now money market funds are very competitive in this environment. Certainly, you know, compared to bank deposits, it really depends on bank relationships. But we found, you know, often clients have to negotiate for higher rates with their banks. They're not automatically raising them as the interest rates increase. Whereas the money market funds, because they're solely composed of securities that are producing income based on the nature of the security and the prevailing interest rate environment, they're essentially adjusting based on the interest rates that are prevailing for today. So in the U.S., you know, we're getting close to nearly 5.5% on some money market funds in terms of performance. And in Europe, similarly, you know, the performance is, you know, in line with the overnight benchmarks rate, and in many cases, you know, above that. Because again, these funds are able to add a little bit of term to portfolio if it makes sense within certain constraints, and so they're able to you know, do slightly better in many cases than the overnight interest rate. But at the same time, their expenses are very low as well, particularly in the institutional space, so that there's not a lot that you're paying into the portfolio for it to have it professionally managed as well.
Super interesting. And so you mentioned there already a difference between the U.S. and Europe. What are the other differences that you might see regionally with money market funds?
Yeah, it's a good question. So there are a couple that are, I'd say, you know, more regulatory and structural based, and then there's just some differences in terms of the environment. So in the United States, the rules governing money market funds are driven by the SEC, and they've had multiple different rounds of reform on money market funds to essentially make them more and more safe and liquid. Hence, we talked about the, you know, move to even 50% liquidity for some of these funds. And so there are some differences. In the U.S., for example, if you're investing in a prime fund, which is essentially a fund that buys corporate and financial debt in addition to government issuance, they carry a variable NAV. So the NAV can fluctuate based on the mark to market.
Can you explain that? Sorry, what's an NAV?
Okay, sure. Yeah. The net asset value, so the price of the fund each day. That can vary each day, and they price themselves out to 4 decimals. And so the price could be 1.001 or 0.9999. So they do have a variable NAV. The nature of the portfolio, though, because they're so short, so high quality, there isn't a lot of variation or volatility in the pricing, but they do have a fixed price to them that's calculated each day. Whereas the government's funds in the U.S. have a stable NAV, so they're valued at amortized cost, and so the NAV each day is $1. And so, because of that, you know, the pricing is essentially known as you're going in. And they do have provisions if the mark-to-market value of a portfolio ever exceeds a certain threshold that they do have to reprice. But essentially, they're stable NAV funds, and so the pricing is, you know, going to be $1 for those funds. In Europe, it's a little bit different. So the regulatory environment is a little different in that they do not have a variable NAV on the same type of prime fund that buys corporate and financial debt in addition to government issuance. They have what's called a low volatility NAV, or LVNAV, And what that is essentially it's stable, valued at amortized cost, very similar to the government funds in the US and the CNAV funds, which are the sovereign funds in Europe. But what they do is if there is a deviation between the mark-to-market value of the portfolio and the amortized cost valuation, so the stable $1 or 1 euro, 1 sterling price, if that band exceeds 20 basis points, so if the mark-to-market value is, for example, greater than 1.020, they'd have to essentially reprice the fund. And so they narrowed the band right now in the US for a stable value fund. It has to shift by 50 basis points, essentially half a cent, to the point where you have to reprice on penny rounding to 99 cents or to $1.01. In Europe, they narrowed that band to 20 basis points, but they allowed for these type of funds to not carry a floating NAV or a variable NAV. They're allowed to be stable unless they break that, what's called a collar. And we've seen, this perform over time. We had, significant interest rate changes, as you mentioned, over the last few years, including, the time in March of 2020, where there were significant cuts to interest rates, across much of the world, particularly in the U.S. And we saw these funds still, even with those type of interest rate shocks, they didn't, because of the nature of the portfolio, there wasn't a significant deviation between that mark-to-market value and the stable price. And so we didn't see, even in those type of environments, any type of action around that. But that's one of the differences. The other difference is just nature of issuance. So in the U.S., there's, in part because of our heavy government debt, there is a lot of issuance of sovereign paper. And so there are lots of treasuries and government agency securities to buy. And so there are a large portion of the volume that goes into money market funds is actually in U.S. government funds, whether it be agencies, treasuries, or a combination. In Europe, it's a little bit harder to find sovereign issuance that is of the credit quality necessary to meet the requirements of a fund. And so you're looking at French paper, German paper, potentially, and Euro government paper. EU development bonds and things like that. So there's a much narrower range of supply of investments. And as a result, there are less funds that are able to invest in those type of products. There's less capacity if you're an investor to invest in a Euro government fund than if you would come to the US and invest in a US government fund.
So first of all, the French at it again, surprisingly. And secondly, does it make it more expensive then to invest in the European money market fund? More expensive in the sense of you will get less interesting interest rates.
Yes, that's okay. The other piece of it is that the funds themselves are not as competitive compared to what you find in the U.S. sovereign versus private sector debt, that there is a larger spread. And so the combination of the regulations where you can still get that stable NAV in a private debt fund while also having a greater spread from, for example, a Euro government fund has made it less attractive to investors as well. And so a combination of supply and demand has made it a smaller part of the market.
Hmm. And sorry, one last question on that, Sebastian, because now we're getting into it and that's super interesting. How big can be the mark-to-market gap anyways? Because it's an overnight investment. So how likely it is that it will all of a sudden be like, oh, but that's not at all what we predicted and we have to revalue. Sorry, go ahead, Zach.
Default. Default is the answer, exactly. Right? I mean, that's what it has to take is significant defaults. Just a pure interest rate move is not usually going to create that kind of valuation bump.
Yeah, exactly. There has to be a default in the portfolio. And again, that's why the portfolios are designed to be only the highest credit quality. So in the US, for example, there's a requirement that all paper in the portfolio be either A1 from Standard & Poor's or higher and P1 from Moody's. And so essentially the highest category of short-term rating. And so the combination of that and the short nature of the portfolio means there's not really a lot of opportunity for the portfolio to move in terms of mark-to-market valuation purely based on normal interest rate cycles or even, somewhat significant shocks to the market. Certainly a really exacerbated shift in the curve could have the potential, but we're talking about, 200-400 basis points where you start to, think about whether there might be a slight impairment to the NAV, not a significant one, but a slight one that might, put you into 99.5 cents or something like that.
Right. Super clear. So let's say I'm a treasurer that just got skyrocketed to the position of group treasurer and I have to invest in money market funds, but I have no clue how to do that. I never received training. Can happen, let's say. How do I actually invest in a money market fund? How does that happen?
It's a great question.
Who do I talk to?
Yeah. So there's a number of different options. You can always go to the fund directly. You can interface directly with the asset manager. When you need to place a trade, you can pick up the phone or in some cases send a fax and engage directly with the asset manager. Some of them have online trading as well.
How can it be over that?
You get a piece of paper and you start writing your name at the top.
that is the DocuSign, but it is essentially still, a piece of paper to open an account. Some have access to money market funds through their banks. So there may be, a bank platform that allows for that type of investment, or maybe a bank makes its own proprietary fund available as part of the sweep program. And then there are platforms such as ours, which are really designed around bringing this marketplace to the corporate treasurer and really easing the requirements to invest in a money market fund, to report on your investments, and then also to analyze the underlying investments of the funds and whether you want to add a particular new fund based on the construct and of its portfolio. And so those are primarily the ways. You can always go to the fund directly. You can potentially access it through your bank. They're making those type of products available, or you can use a platform such as ours that brings the marketplace to you.
And so let's dive into exactly this. Like the platform such as yours, it's called an investment portal, right?
Yes.
Can you explain us how it works exactly, and maybe in the details of how does it interface between the corporate treasurer and I imagine the asset managers or maybe the banks proposing those money market funds? And why would I use that as a treasurer rather than just calling my bank?
Yeah, so the way the platform works is we provide the marketplace to the end investor. So as a client of ICD or many other online investment portals, entirely web-based. So you sign up with the platform, you receive a login into the system, and there's some setup involved in terms of where you pick funds and different ways that you want to settle with those funds, and there are different options available for types of settlement. But once you've made those selections, then you have sort of the universe available to you on any given day. It's as simple as clicking a P or R button or purchase or redemption to place a trade. And then on the back end, we're set up with all of the funds that are on our platform. We have distribution agreements to be able to offer their funds through our platform. And then we interface directly and electronically with all of the funds, and that can take various different methods, whether it be Swift standard in Europe or different standards in the US. Communicate all of our client trades either directly with the funds or if we're using an intermediary as well to help consolidate some of that activity via that intermediary and then ultimately into the funds as well.
So it's a marketplace. It gives me access to all the potential or most of the options out there. And probably one of the main advantage, I don't have to send a letter or sign a DocuSign. It's done through my investment portal. Why would that be more relevant? And maybe this question is interested in the sense of earlier you mentioned, Sebastian, that the return, the interest rate you might get on a money market fund, if as a treasurer you need to discuss it directly with your bank, is not guaranteed. Like you have to negotiate a higher interest rate. And I suspect that with such a solution, you could, ICD or the investment portal solution providers, be like leveraging that scale, leveraging that volumes of investment to negotiate much higher interest rates for the end user. So here I'm a bit answering to my own question, but I see that as an advantage. Is it actually accurate? Like, is it what that allows? And what are the other advantages of using such platforms?
Yeah, so it's a good question. Taking the US as an example, you cannot, for example, treat shareholders differently. So we couldn't get a preferential rate specifically for our investors versus others. That being said, there are different share classes of funds. So there are funds that have higher expense ratios, and then the same portfolio may have for the larger investor a share class that has a lower expense ratio. And that allows you to essentially lower your expenses and through that, have a higher yield. So it's not so much of a handshake and negotiation, more so than making available to our investor the best in class funds that are available in the marketplace, and giving them access to those that, in some cases they may not be able to access on their own directly.
And so to play the devil's advocate here, Sebastian, and I'm thinking about my own deals in my private life, like when I have to invest into stocks or securities, I can either go through my bank, who will take a very juicy commission. I can choose an independent platform, which will take a lower a lower commission, but a commission nonetheless. How does it work for the treasurer side using such platform? Because you add an intermediary, so obviously there needs to be a cut somewhere. How does that work?
Well, it's a great question. So, and it's an important question because our platform is free to our end users. We don't charge them anything for access, but they also don't receive any haircut as a result of trading through us. So all of these funds, you buy into fund XYZ, they have a fixed expense ratio. That's a portion of the fund. And so that fund will charge the same expenses if you go to that fund directly or through an intermediary. And so we are compensated out of that existing expense ratio. And so as a client, there's no net difference to you whether you trade through us or go to the fund directly. There's no haircut taken on top. It's not like we're marking the securities up like you would in a traditional equity market maker environment. Essentially, we are paid by the funds as an outsource of distribution. And so rather than having to have a sales force of 10 people to cover various different regions, they use us as a means to distribute their funds. And so that lowers their overall distribution costs and they're able to share some of that distribution costs with us.
Okay. And so is that why you guys are considered like an independent fund investment portal? Sorry. Is that the difference that you're like the sales reps for the banks?
Our independence, I think, extends farther than that. So we do have some other competitors in the marketplace that aren't independent. So, some of the banks, for example, have their own version of a money market portal that essentially allows you to do things very similar to what we do, invest in the marketplace. In those instances, there's often, preferential treatment for their own internal liquidity products. There might be special discounts or something that they give or special incentives on the banking side that they give to clients. And so it's not a neutral and unbiased environment.
Do they work with multiple banks though, or they work with one bank?
So a bank platform will work with multiple providers, but as you might expect, there's always a preference for, where possible, utilization of their own internal liquidity products. And at the same time, they do also have visibility into all of your investments. And so they know if you're giving money to bank A, B, or C through your investments. And so as a result, there is some transparency that may not always be advantageous to the treasurer by having a single bank be the intermediary between all of their cash.
Yeah, that makes sense indeed. And the fees on those, like, would they charge different fees if you use someone other bank's MMF versus theirs?
I wouldn't say they charge different fees. I'd say it's possible, though, that there could be advantageous placement of their product versus their competitor bank products. So a better share class of their own funds than what they might potentially make available from a competitive fund that's on their platform that's owned by another bank.
So is that independence the main consideration when treasurers should be looking for somewhere for a platform to invest their money market fund, or are there other considerations?
And that's definitely part of it. We've seen a lot of our clients really value the independence for a number of the reasons that we talk about, in part as well, the fact that they're not comfortable having a single bank having visibility into all of their investments. But there are other things to look for as well. What's the service model associated with the platform? How are they supporting the software that's available? For us, we have trade desks that are staffed by licensed professionals 17 to 18 hours of the day. So whether you're picking up the phone in Europe or in the West Coast in the US, you can pick up and call a live person to handle any question you might have about a fund or the status of a transaction in addition to what's already available online. So that's a key component, I think, of the consideration. And then there's also the technical components. Many platforms that are out there, from the banks and others, are kind of way ancillary businesses for them. For us, this is our primary focus. And so we have a heavy investment in technology and are committed to making sure that we can connect into whatever system our clients are looking to have data flow into. And that's become one of the major evolutions in the market over the last 10 years, is really a focus on digitization of treasury. And whether it be a treasury management system, a fully capable ERP system, accounting system, or a risk management system, there are more and more digital solutions to being able to consolidate data. And we'll talk a little bit later about one that we have as well. It's definitely a key component of the decision process these days. Is I have this TMS, I have this ERP, I use this accounting system. Can the data that exists on the platform on my investments easily and seamlessly flow into those systems? And when it comes to a TMS, can it also be part of the operational workflow? Can placing a trade on the portal will automatically queue up a wire for approval or even send it straight away so that it's a fully STP process. And you know, because of our singular focus on this market, it's allowed us to really be able to bring those type of solutions to our clients that might be a little bit more challenging for those where it's just an ancillary business of what they do.
And then you also need to do the same connection and digitization on the bank side to be able to access all these different funds, right? Which banks are notorious for not being the most advanced in their connectivity protocols, let's say.
Yes, and we've encountered that in terms of our attempts to interact with all of the various different banks and asset managers. And there are different protocols in different areas of the world. And so being able to be flexible and adaptable as a technology, being able to move into the newer APIs as they're coming available slowly but surely in the financial marketplace is a critical thing as well. And so having an open architecture system and a team that's constantly developing against it is really advantageous for us in the marketplace of being able to bring in new types of products, new sorts of investments that may be more challenging for those that are more set in kind of an institutional framework can bring to the marketplace.
I mean, how can you not be digital, right? And because if you're talking short-term investments and you're talking, okay, where am I going to put my cash tonight? Treasury's logging in at 5 p.m. And saying PST, also where the East Coast has already gone to sleep or gone out to dinner or whatever, then you can't have a phone call confirmation or a manual person confirming a trade, right? So it needs to be digital. Do you see it? Does that exist at all? Like digital, like non-digital versions? Oh. Is it just like a gradient of digital, or do you also have the manual?
There do still exist manual protocols today, and obviously there are those challenges getting somebody a hold of somebody past hour. I mean, I think the financial system certainly has moved to some form of digital. Whether they're the most advanced and efficient forms of digital is an open question. But there is a version of digital, but being able to move alongside improvements. So things like APIs where you can get real-time feedback, if there's any problems in the process versus waiting for a file to come back. These are real advantages that allow you to make ultimately quicker decisions around your cash and the way you want to deploy it.
Super interesting. Not too bad at all. And so is that the connectivity tool that you guys are most invested in? Is it APIs? Is that the...
Well, I mean, of course, we'd love to invest in APIs, Hasan. I think this is one of the things that what Sebastian was kind of highlighting, especially on the institutional side, banks and other financial providers have been very slow to roll out APIs. And so, and we can talk about it once we get to the portfolio analytics conversation, but you have to be able to handle a very wide range of data integrations from, unstructured data sets in a PDF that someone took a picture of off their desk to, API integrations to, flat files, which is probably the most common that we still see today, CSVs coming in on a SFTP server. So you have to be able to handle a huge variety if you're going to play in this marketplace, and making that an easy decision for the treasurer, right? Taking that off their desk. We handle that part of it is a huge part of the value that we bring to these organizations, right? So if they were going to go out and trade direct with 100 different funds, they would have to set up 100 different integrations that are all going to look a little different. They're all going to be challenging. And so they usually don't, right? They'll go and they'll choose two. That leaves you with two options when you go to make an investment decision. And because you don't have insight into the other 150 you could be investing in, that puts you at a disadvantage, period, right? Forget everything else, that puts you at a disadvantage. And so providing kind of the operational back end to these firms, to allow these firms to really optimize their decisions around investing, is really where we shine.
But so, Zach, that's perfect. Let us bring you in here and let's dive into this. So you've recently announced, you as in ICD, but also indirectly Sebastian and Zach, right? The release of that new solution. I think the announcement was at the AFP conference in San Diego. So what is that new solution is? And maybe to tell us the story, can you start by highlighting the problem statement? I think you touched upon it already, that problem of the choice that is offered to you if you have to handle that many connections. But overall, what is the problem statement and something you've seen in the market that needed a solution for? And how did you come up with a solution for it?
Okay. Yeah, so I think Sebastian was kind of highlighting this earlier about kind of the options that customers have. So a treasurer often will have different allocations and like, let's say three different categories of investing, right? They'll have allocations to their banks, right? We talked about that. They always have to have operational bank accounts. They may have some demand deposits, may have some time deposits. They have different products that they're engaged with their banks and their bank allocations. Then they have fund allocations, right? Just like this, money market funds, short duration funds, ETFs, whatever their fund allocations are. And then they often also have either direct trading in-house, like if they're big enough to actually trade treasuries or, you know, maybe some commercial paper program or something they're doing in-house, or they'll go out and hire an asset manager, right? To manage an SMA, a separately managed account for them, to make trades on their behalf and to, you know, hit some strategy. Well, those are relatively operationally independent concepts to a treasurer, right? So they process their cash and get their reporting on their cash balances, often from their treasury workstation. Treasury management solution, treasury workstation, what is my balance in this bank account? What is my balance, you know, over here? How do I, you know, wire money from this bank account to that bank account? When they're trading funds, they're doing so often through a portal like ourselves, hopefully us, but they could be doing it through one portal, maybe multiple portals, depending on, you know, how their business is structured. Or they may be going direct in some instances, right? So they may have some that they're doing direct. And then they also usually have some allocation to an SMA where they're going maybe out further on the duration curve and, you know, buying corporate bonds or something like that. And each one of those is relatively, you know, so from a SMA perspective, they might be reporting on that from their custodian or their asset manager. And they come at different frequencies with different data sets on them. But when they want to see across all of that, they don't really have a great option, right? And so most of these firms are doing giant Excel spreadsheets that have, a series of macros built on top of them over the last few decades that try to normalize data from a portal like ourselves. Hey, here's all your dividends that you received, and here's all your positions in your different money market funds. And then from their treasury workstation, okay, I pulled this file down, and it's got all of our bank allocations formatted in this way and rolled up like this. And then, oh yeah, I'm also going to pull my, you know, custodial statement or my investment manager report, and I'm going to try to squeeze all that together just to say, how much exposure do I have to Wells Fargo, right? Because that's what I'm really trying to say is like, okay, I just want to know what percentage of my portfolio is exposed. And I think you guys highlighted earlier, right, that most of these treasurers are so short on the curve that, you know, interest rate fluctuations, well, of course it matters to them what they can earn on their cash. It's not going to really, you know, create huge volatility in their NAV, right? Their overall value of their portfolio is not going to dramatically shift. But credit exposure, right, an actual credit event is much more impactful to them. So, you know, things like we saw in the spring with the bank failures or any other market, you know, market event that would cause failures either in the, you know, in the private space or the public space, are really things that they have to be monitoring for. And so most of the time when you look at an investment policy, they're heavily focused on, you know, the credit issues. And so understanding what that looks like across all three of those segments we talked about of their investment portfolio is a challenge that's relatively unsolved in the space. So we built a solution that's specifically built to solve that problem. And just like we were talking about with being able to handle that kind of wide variety of, you know, integration points, that same technology helps us in this area as well, right? So we're able to bring in, we're agnostic to file format, file frequency, file type, file content, and we bring all of that data in automatically from all these different sources on the behalf of the customer. We then normalize that, and this is where like the AI pieces come into place, where we're trying to normalize the different data sets, link them all up, like, you know, these are the underlying holdings of this fund is held in this account, and this account is, you know, and this fund's parent is this, and this parent's, you know, located in France. Like all those linkings that you have to do, and the rating for that, you know, the S&P long-term rating is, you know, AA. Like linking all those different disparate data sets together means that you've got a lot of moving pieces in those giant spreadsheets that people are trying to create that they often break, that, you know, especially when you have changes to the data that's being provided. You know, and you know, that guy quit 3 years ago, and so now we don't know how that macro works anymore. Like, you're laughing probably because you've heard these things, right? Like, this is exactly what happens. And so you end up, honestly, like most firms end up like not doing it at the frequency they want, not doing it at the granularity that they want, or not doing it accurately, right? So they're just going for their top five counterparts. Like, I can't figure out anything else other than my top five or whatever, right? So, you know, they limit themselves dramatically in order to try to be able to execute on it. And so we're trying to solve that problem for these firms. And again, we're going to bring that together and we make all that information, right? We bring all that data together, we normalize it, and we link it all up with all that risk information. And then we provide it to you both in like a dedicated reporting solution, but also create it, put it at your fingertips when you're making those allocation decisions. So not only are we doing like a counterparty exposure report, right? Where you can like set limits to say, hey, I only want to be exposed, you know, 3% of my total portfolio to Wells Fargo. Tell me how close I am, you know, that kind of thing. Notify me when I'm out of compliance. But also, like, when I'm going to make allocation decisions, what if I were to get out of this fund and go into this other product? Or what if I moved that money to this bank, you know, balance or into this SMA? What would my portfolio look like in that situation, right? So we're kind of supporting their allocation decisions because they're making those allocation decisions within our platform. But we're also supporting kind of the risk evaluation and understanding of that portfolio at a much more holistic view than most of them usually get. And we're doing so at a frequency and an accuracy rate that's much higher than what they're used to seeing.
Mm. Awesome. So if I may try to summarize this, that, and tell me if I'm wrong. So the problem that ICD's platform to begin with solves is for choice and access. Like through ICD, you can basically have access to a whole range of money market funds or investment tools that you might not have access to if it wasn't for this, because of this very problem of connectivity, data reconciliation, but also access, being able to know what's what and where and so on and so forth. And then for the portfolio analytics, then you have a clear visibility on revenues and dividends, but that's not the main point. And that's super interesting that you highlighted that it's actually mainly for the counterparty exposure. And that's ultra relevant because of the time we're in right now. And we've already talked about SVB earlier, and there has been others, even in Europe, like UniCredit was in a particular situation, and it shows that banks can still fail. It can still happen. And the problem that solves is we're going to help you manage your exposure whilst offering you a whole range of investment opportunities that you might choose from. And then you have this mobilized reporting.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not just counterparty. I mean, I was using counterparty as an example, but like that's the one that's most recent. Right. If you think about it, right, that's the one that's most, you know, at the top of everybody's mind. But you also have geopolitical, right? Like, I want to understand what my exposure is to Ukraine, right? That was a big deal before the bank failures were, you know, maybe it still is a big deal, right, for some firms. Or, you know, what is my exposure to a given market segment? So asset-backed commercial papers blowing up. What's going on there? What is my total exposure to that? Like, it allows you to kind of slice that data set in 100 different ways to kind of see what your exposures are to different risks, right? And so as those risks evolve and as the market changes and exposes new challenges to a treasurer, they have a platform in which they can see those, you know, see those exposures without saying, I'm going to solve my counterparty exposure and then I'm not going to be able to solve anything else. Because as soon as my boss says, what is our exposure to asset-backed commercial paper? I'm going to have to throw up my hands and go, well, let's start over. Where do we have where's my spreadsheet, right? And I think that is the most common situation we find treasurers is they're doing, you know, most of them have had shrinking teams, with growing responsibility, and that combination has created them to like slice down to just what's absolutely necessary for me to get through my quarterly reporting or get my monthly statements out or whatever, right? So, and that's super common, and everybody we talk to is in the same boat there. They're either, you know, looking to build something to solve this problem internally, like some giant data warehouse that they're trying to build themselves. They're trying to leverage, you know, a new analytics platform to solve 700 things, but also this, you know, and then that creates challenges in the firm. Or they're just, you know, we assign, you know, tons of hours of different individuals within my group just so they can tell me what the answer is to, you know, what percentage of my portfolio, not to analyze whether or not that's a good exposure or not, just to tell me what percentage is, you know, to a given question, right? You know, this product allows them to, you know, eliminate that operational burden, just like the operational burden we were talking about on the portal side, where, you know, and they no longer have to think about, okay, how do I settle with this one? Oh, okay, I got to make sure I send a file or, you know, fax a piece of paper that's different to this organization than to that organization and whatever to settle this trade. Instead, they can say, you know what, my job is to look for the best, you know, be a good fiduciary for my company's investment portfolio and understand what the risks are, how I maximize the return while also maintaining the liquidity that my company needs. That's my job, not operationally pushing buttons in order to get a number out the other side. So we eliminate a huge chunk of that for those firms.
Makes a lot of sense. And yes, we've heard a lot about this Excel shaman guru, however you might want to call it in your company. And then all of a sudden he or she leaves, and that's That's
yeah, I mean, with the great, what did they call it? The great
resignation.
Yeah, great resignation. A lot of firms lost that person, or with a lot of folks, you know, they're retiring too. So like, as your company, you know, changes over folks and hires the person for the right job, or moves, you know, wants to, you know, a big part of it's like, you might want to actually give that person a promotion and move them to a different level of responsibility. If they're the one person who knows how to run the Excel spreadsheet, then it's really hard to manage your people that way too. So again, there's a lot of reasons why a company doesn't want to be doing it that way. But if you look across the, you know, the treasury organizations internationally, almost all of them are. And so like, it seems like a, you know, it definitely is resonating with a lot of the people we talk to. It's like, this is a problem that's unsolved and is material to my decision-making, especially in times of uncertainty, right? And so you have to plan ahead for times of uncertainty. You can't try to react when those things happen because, you know, these types of systems do not implement themselves, right? And so if you want to do this with Excel or whatever, you know, now I want to understand my exposure by this metric or whatever, good luck building that in time where it's relevant, right? Like by the time something happens, you know, you don't have the time to react. So anyway, it's a really exciting platform that we've had a lot of success with. And it's aimed at that same user that we aim at with the portal and leverages a lot of our expertise in interacting with different financial institutions.
But this, like, can this be web-based?
It is completely web-based.
Integrated into the company's internal system, right?
Yeah, so it's the same login. So, you know, we talked a little bit about how Portal is free, right? So you can set up accounts on the Portal, start trading tomorrow, you know, without paying us a dime. Portfolio Analytics is a little bit different because we're dealing with investments that are outside of our purview. We do not, you know, they're not traded on our platform. We do charge for that product, but it's the exact same login that you would use when you're trading. Again, it's actually the same dashboards that you get when you're doing trading. You can build a special dashboard that just gives you your counterparty risk, that gives you your maturity bands, that gives you your you know, ratings allocations, right? And we're going to pull through all the underlying data from all the underlying funds and do your proportional allocation. So Sebastian was talking about kind of prime funds, right, that invest in different products. You know, in Europe, you know, it's much more common to see people investing, you know, in a fund that has, you know, tons of different counterparties underneath it. Well, if you're trying to decide how much I'm exposed to Credit Suisse, you can't just be looking at, you know, my bank deposit at Credit Suisse. That's not the entire picture, right? You've got some indirect exposure through fund products. You've got some direct exposure through a sponsored program that they're putting on for a CP, you know, that you directly own. You need to aggregate all of that up to say, okay, what is my total exposure if Credit Suisse were to have some challenges here? If Credit Suisse goes through some challenge, what is my overall exposure going to look like? And so this platform really allows treasury professionals to do that, you know, easily and quickly, and react to, you know, new market events as they happen.
Super interesting. Zach, our ears pricked up a little bit. You said AI.
Very common. Very common, yes.
Exactly. You can't get away with saying without explaining on the Corporate Treasury podcast. So explain to us how you guys are using AI. I think you mentioned working with structured data. So we're working with data in different formats and formatting it to the correct format.
Yeah, I mean, there's two areas where we use AI and machine learning today. One of them is exactly like you're describing, so unstructured data sets, right? So being able to extract data from file types in a wide variety and do so, you know, reliably and accurately is something that, you know, we've seen a lot of new AI technologies in place to do those types of things. We take advantage of a lot of AI in data extraction is what we call it. But then there's also the idea of joining data sets. So a given customer has on a single day, has around 250 joins of data, 250,000 joins of data sets that they have to make in order to create that picture. So that's one of the reasons why those spreadsheets are so big and you get bogged down and they stop running and they, you know, close themselves or whatever when you're trying to do them, is that you've got huge numbers of data sets that you're trying to figure out and join together. And those data sets don't traditionally have like IDs. You're not going to do a join like you would a traditional, you know, SQL database join. And so you have to use machine learning to do the matches. When it says GLD, that means Goldman. When it says, you know, and so you're dynamically creating rules that are then applied to these data sets to create the joins that create you know, an actually valuable set of information across your portfolio. And so we use a lot, we use it in extraction, but we also use it in kind of that matching and joining of these different disparate data sets to create a rich view of your portfolio.
Is that, because it seems like that's probably the only manual task remaining in a lot of these departments, right? Is where indeed all these different PDFs you receive, reports that you receive, etc., are all in these little different formats. Obviously none of the banks ever sit down to unify formatting of anything. And that's the biggest problem everyone has.
Well, I mean, we've had lots of promises over the years, Hisham, of like the standard that is coming. LEIs are promised, you know, we've had, you know, DUNS numbers promised to us. Like we've RIC codes, and like there's probably a bajillion different attempts at this and different levels of adoption across the different organizations that exist. And I think it's a, you know, the reality is as a treasurer, you can't wait for your all of your banks to start generating APIs, for you to start understanding what your exposures are. You can't wait for all of your, all of your file types to match and be in a format that works and is similar across all of your different sources. If you do, you're going to be waiting a while. I can tell you that, right? So in the interim, you're going to be putting your portfolio at risk. And so they have to deal with the here and now. And in most cases, that means exactly what you're describing. Very different data sets, very different file types, very different, you know, just data set, you know, data granularity, right? So, you know, I might get a, you know, count level balances from this file, but you get, you know, position level balances over here and lot level information over there. Just that alone can be challenging to reconcile, you know, forget, you know, that when it says GLD, that means Goldman Sachs, right? Or when it says, you see, you know, it's in this other language and it says something else, and that means, or 001754234 means this, right? Like there's a ton of those types of things that exist, right? And and you talk to these firms, like a lot of people like have those numbers in their head, right? You say like, what's your account number for this? Guess what? They know it. They probably know what their account numbers are. Why? Because they have to type it in like 600 times and they're mapping it to 100 different things in their systems, right? You know, those. We know the treasury professional and how much of that they're doing. And when you look at this problem, you know, it's again, unsolved in the industry. And it's something that everybody is largely trying to do in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think remembering your 400 bank accounts number by heart take quite some headspace that you could use for something else.
Something more important, yeah.
Exactly. Zach, do you also offer analytics and this overall counterparty exposure management for investments that are not made through the ICD platform?
Yes. So we absolutely incorporate anything that's made through the ICD platform. But the real important differentiator here is we've been producing reporting on stuff that you buy through the ICD platform for 20 years, right? The big change here is we're going to bring in data that's not traded through the ICD platform. So you have a separate mandate with somebody else and you want to bring in that data. You have bank balances with hundreds of banks, just like you described, 400 bank accounts. And I want to bring in data about those investments. And then I want to join all of that together, right? I want to see my entire portfolio. And in most cases, our customers, only a segment of their portfolio, just like Sebastian was talking about, right? It's a tool in their toolbox, money market funds, or a tool in their toolbox. They got seven other tools they're using. And the more complex, the more different types of tools that they're leveraging, the harder this problem gets, right? If I'm, you know, if I've got SMAs in Europe and I got SMAs in the US and I got some, you know, weird fund that I have to invest in over here and I've got, you know, a 400 different bank accounts with 30 different banks, you know, all over the world, trying to see aggregated across all those what my maturity band is for my current liquidity, like, is really, really challenging to understand, right? So how much do I have in less than 15 days maturity? That's a really hard answer for a lot of treasury groups to answer when they look across all of that, right? And so that's the kind of problem we're trying to solve here.
That's awesome. And so from the technical perspective, how do you get all the data? Because I easily understand how you can report on all the investment made through ICD's platform. But then how do you, so do you link to the TMS/payment factory/EBS?
Yep. Oh, so so each customer is different, right? This is one of the, you know, other the challenges, right? So each customer has a different set of providers that they're dealing with, right? So a lot of customers have treasury workstations, but about half our customers don't. Okay, so if we want to get data about your bank balances, we might go to your Treasury workstation and pull a file from there, because it's an aggregate view of your bank balances. But you might not. Maybe you've only got 5 or 6 different banking relationships that you do with. Maybe you have an aggregator, right? A bank aggregator. Either way, we'll go to those solutions and pull data from them at whatever frequency they can provide it. And I think this is the problem, right? We're solving the problem of, you know, file type, file frequency, file, you know, source, all that stuff that's messy when you actually come in and you're saying, okay, I'm a new treasurer in this organization and I want to solve for this problem. Well, this treasury, you know, this organization looks different than my last organization. Of course it does. It has different types of, you know, banking relationships. It has different types of investments. It has different risk tolerances for what they're doing with their investment portfolio. And so we have to be able to handle, yeah, all those different banking institutions. But then, like, it's very common for us to go to, you know, your custodial bank to get your SMA data, right? So you hire a custodian, you hire an investment manager, your investment manager is making investment decisions within that mandate. We'll go to your custodian and get a daily overnight file from your custodian and bring in all of your corporate bond portfolio that we don't offer through our platform, corporate bond trading. So that is, you know, completely done by your investment manager, and we're going to pull that data in. And the challenge that most people have is you can't treat corporate bond positions the same as an underlying holding in a fund, the same as a bank allocation, but you need to join all three of those data sets together in order to get a holistic view of things like counterparty risk. And so they're very different levels of granularity. They're very different structures to those data sets, but you have to bring all of them together. And that's why those spreadsheets are so messy when they try to take a look at that stuff.
Super clear. And just for the sake of clarity, Zach, because as you might have noticed in this episode, we love to chase down acronyms and break them down. But by SMA, you mean separately managed accounts, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's a separately managed account. You've hired an investment manager. But, you know, that's the only distinction between that and like a directly held investment is who's managing the assets, right? So a directly traded investment would be traded by your own internal personnel. So Hussam, we hire you, you're going to manage this specific portfolio for our company. And then we might also go and hire JP Morgan to manage a different mandate for us. And so the JP Morgan fund is a SMA and Hussam's is a internally, you know, a directly traded portfolio.
Hussam at par with JPM.
You against JPM. I'm sure you
can. If JPM is listening, we love him.
Awesome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything that you'd like to add to any of the topics that we've touched on today? Anything we missed or anything that you feel like you'd like to add a nuance to?
I mean, I think just one thing is that, and kind of it dovetails through everything that we've talked about, is what we've seen in the marketplace over the last 6 to 9 months is that people are really taking a fresh look at their cash. Corporate treasury is really trying to understand, you know, what are my exposures? Where do I have risks in my portfolio? And then where can I add diversification? And so, you know, we've seen a significant amount of interest in folks in using products like money market funds to get diversification, but then also using technology in various different instances, including through our portfolio analytics, to really understand what are my overall risks in my portfolio, because we've just been through that period. And so we are starting to see a shift where, you know, it takes time, but it continues to be ongoing, where folks are really taking a fresh look at their overall investment portfolio and saying, am I comfortable with both, you know, the content of the portfolio, but also the reporting that's available through it.
I mean, we're in a shift of, you know, I guess international finance that is, you know, dramatic. Probably the only time in our lifetimes we'll see this big of a shift from, you know, basically a zero rate market for what, 20 years to, you know, higher longer, maybe question mark. I don't know, like a new world. And so it really does causes a lot of concern, of course, with the existing structures that people have, but also as an opportunity to relook at, okay, what are the things in my portfolio that, you know, the things that I want to optimize for in my treasury portfolio. And so we've, you know, everybody we talk to is taking a look at what technologies they're using, what, you know, investment decisions they've been made historically, and what new strategies should they, you know, adopt in the future. And so it's a very dynamic time to be in treasury.
Amen. 100%. Finally, guys, where can listeners find out more about you guys, ICT Portal, ICT in general? Where should they go?
Yeah, absolutely. So they can go to icdportal.com and they can get more information on both the ICD portal and ICD portfolio analytics. We have a lot of great resources that are available to them, and they can read case studies from different treasury teams for how they put some of these products to bear. And so there's a lot of rich information available. And so we encourage them to visit our website and contact us through that as well. But appreciate you guys in the conversation and looking forward to more conversations in the future about these type of topics.
Yes, thank you both. Really appreciate you guys having us on.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.